Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later in the hour, we'll get a preview of Darwin Day in Iowa City. It's a chance for scientists, teachers, and the public to learn from leading evolutionary biologists. I will talk with Harmeet Malik about what we can learn from ancient viruses. But first, for nearly 50 years, Benjamin Honeycutt has been researching, teaching, and writing about how we work, live, and recreate. He's a historian, so he can help us understand how we became the work-obsessed culture we are today. But he's also been trying to help people strike a better work-life balance and to seek out work and leisure that actually makes us happier. He's the author of a number of books and is a University of Iowa professor of sport and recreation management. He has been with the university since 1975, and now he is moving into his next chapter of retirement. Ben, welcome back to Talk of Iowa.
Charity, thank you so much for having me back. Always a pleasure.
Well, it is wonderful to have you here. And I would love for you to take us back to the beginning of your career. What captured your interest in how we work and the history of work in this country?
Well, it's a long story, but there's been some consistency in what I've been trying to do that brought me to study the things that I've been studying. Originally at Chapel Hill, I had interest in religion. I thought about becoming a minister or a priest. Thank goodness I didn't do that. I'm not suited at all. I know that about myself. But as taking classes in religious studies at Chapel Hill, I began to read historians who relativized religion, one of which was a Herodotus, who said that historians should write not just about politics and war, but also about religion, what people believe and value. I also came across in my studies Max Weber, Protestant Ethic in the Spirit of Capitalism. And he writes about work and how work from the Protestant Reformation becomes an end in itself. Unlike any people in the world, moderns in the Western world look at work as an end in itself rather than a means to an end. Look at work for meaning, purpose, identity, unlike any other people in the world. That caught my attention. Yeah. I wanted to pursue that idea, to write a history of that work and how it has become central to our existence and the steps along the way where it becomes more and more part of our life so that we don't recognize that there is an alternative. So what I've been trying to do is write a history of alternatives, the persistence of the old view of work as a means to an end, and the emergence of a challenge to what I've called this work faith, this modern religion that we're so caught up in. So that's been sort of the thread in my academic life that's been constant, trying to write that history of work by writing a history of leisure, too, as a challenge, as an alternative, as a persistence of an old view that we're working in order to do better things. Now, work is that better thing. We work for more work, which is a curious sort of place to be, but it's a good story to tell that hasn't been fully told yet.
Well, and our understanding of work, I mean, our relationship with work has evolved, but our understanding of work has also evolved. And during that period of time when we were seeing the fight for a 5-day work week instead of working 7 days of the week or an 8-hour work day, that kind of thing, there were futurists who were saying that in the future, we would work a whole lot less. We are working toward this future. That future has not come to be.
not just utopian futurist at all. They were actually preparing and putting on the table various types of activities that would be an alternative to work. We go back to the colonial days. Jonathan Edwards, the old famous preacher, do you know, sinners in the hand of an angry God, an old Puritan. Said, well, he writes about it. In 1740s, he writes about the coming age when more and more of our necessary tasks would be done by machines. Technology would free us. But he goes further than that. During the Great Awakening, when this religious fervor spread through New England, he records, as a historian, he claims to be a historian, he records the various types of activities that people were engaging in outside of their work that were in preparation for the coming of the kingdom of God. here are these people full of religious enthusiasm, singing, praying, living, communing together in ways they've never got together before, building these forms of community, and he says that we're doing it now. We're preparing for the kingdom, but we've got a taste of it now, and we can build on these actual. And going further, this idea of secularized with people like Walt Whitman, who are putting on the table not just the prospect of free time, but also, what are we going to be doing? And Whitman, for example, offers himself as a specimen, the erotic word, building connections between people in conversations, in poetry, where we learn more and more how to share our lives together, how to be better parents, be better neighbors with people. So building community, always a strong shoe. People like Frank Lloyd Wright thought that we would all have the potential to build our own homes, a Usonian house. He uses his architecture, his free spaces in his buildings. If you remember, say, Falling Water, parallel, almost like the buildings floating.
Right, right.
He uses the free space. He says this in a couple places. He uses a free space that typifies his architecture as a metaphor for leisure, for free time that is increasing, that he says is inevitable. As machines take our work, we will inevitably have to deal with this time, either as unemployment or as free time. And he has a remedy. He suggests that we all would enjoy building our own homes, at least taking a part in it.
Right.
Learning how to do it by doing it itself. Learn by doing. Montessori schools were influential for Wright. So
I'm not sure that sounds like leisure to me, but
well, it does for a whole lot of people.
Right.
There's a whole industries built on people's working with wood and building their own whatever. Just do it yourself. A lot of people find a great deal of pleasure in
working with their hands.
Yeah, absolutely.
So much of the conversation about leisure that we see in the historical record is driven by people of privilege, because people of privilege had more free time, had the wealth to have people to do the cooking and the cleaning and all of those things that the rest of us try to fit into our free time for them. So is that a problem when you look at the history of leisure and work in this country, that our understanding of leisure was an understanding of privilege?
A number of writers who are defending increasing leisure for the masses do look back to the Greek ideal. And the Greek ideal was based on privilege, on a few people, women and slaves, doing all the work. And you have a few people who are able to have this free time, and which, of course, Plato, Aristotle thought was the purpose of civilization, is this culture, practicing the culture. In the 20th century, people like Frank Lloyd Wright and Robert Hutchins, a famous president of the University of Chicago, talked about machine slaves, that the Greek ideal can be democratized so that all of us, having the machine as a slave, Ersatz slave, a fill-in slave for us, like the aristocracy of mm-hmm. the Greeks, we would have that opportunity. Everyone, every man, every woman would have that opportunity for leisure, for free time. And so it was a job for Robert Hutchins of the schools to address that coming age of leisure, teaching people those skills necessary for living free, the liberal arts. The liberal arts are called liberal arts not because a bunch of us pinko professors teach it, but it's called the liberal arts. They're the free arts. Instead, we've turned, of course, higher education into education for work, which right. for a number of people.
Well, there's an ongoing conflict about that for sure.
It is.
But the idea was to give people the intellectual opportunity to enjoy their freedom.
Exactly. Exactly. Or to teach the skills of freedom, music, conversation, curiosity, reading, as a leisure activity, something that they would enjoy doing. I tell my classes that we hope to teach you to not just to read and write, but the pleasure of it, that I would hope, I tell my students, as you have a list of things that you really want to read, a list of things that you're thinking about I could write, express myself, ways of expressing, to realize one's full humanity outside of the marketplace, outside of work. In work, we tend to do one thing, but in the realm of freedom, we have more choices. We have more of an opportunity to explore, to look for things new, but we do need the skills. That's where education comes in, the skills of freedom that like the plastic arts, like rhetoric and so forth, are the skills of freedom.
Well, we'll talk more in a moment about your understanding of happiness and what you've been able to pass on to your students and to the rest of us as well, and also what you're looking forward to in retirement. We have to take a short break, but with me right now is Benjamin Honeycutt. He is a professor of sport and recreation management at the University of Iowa, author of many books as well. He's been at the University of Iowa since 1975 and is now embarking on his retirement. Also, just about 20 minutes from now, we will get a preview of Darwin Day at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com. Support for IPR comes from The Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about The Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me now is Benjamin Honeycutt. He is a professor of sport and recreation management at the University of Iowa. He is also a historian, and he has spent more than 50 years now studying how we work, how we recreate, how we live. And now that he is embarking on his retirement, we've asked him to join us to give us a few parting words of wisdom, although I hope you'll be back again in future years as well. We've talked a lot about work and our understanding of leisure. When did you first start thinking about happiness and studying happiness in a way that you could help people make their lives better?
Well, I think from the very beginning, the idea of the pursuit of happiness, when Thomas Jefferson writes that phrase, he had in mind something like, what's worth doing for itself, what's after work make us truly happy. So all along, I think that's been part of, in the background, the pursuit of happiness a la Jefferson. But only recently, within the last 10 years, have I really turned my attention to the new sciences of happiness that there's so much that's been done in the last 20 years. And maybe that's why I haven't come across it, hadn't been there.
Right.
So it's about 20 years old, 25 years old. Neurobiology, positive psychology have made an enormous contributions. Well, they found a lot of the keys to that age-old puzzle, what makes us happy. They've done all this wonderful empirical research,
right,
and they've found some great stuff. And they really try to make it available to us all. They write books. They hold seminars. They are on the web, internet, all over the place. Dan Siegel, for example, a neurobiologist, I recommend him highly. He has a couple of websites. A long list. If you look up positive psychology, you come up Seligman at Penn State. And what I try to do in my class is sort of summarize the major findings, which is doable. They do it for you, actually. They write books. I'm not a psychologist or neurobiologist, but I can read what they've made available. They are very interested in getting the word out. This wonderful research.
Well, and you've done so much to synthesize that research with your research about work and leisure in our lives, because so many of us make bad choices about what makes us happy. Yep. We're such a work-focused society. So what do you want your students, what do you want all of us to know about pursuing a life that will be centered around work, but making better choices that may lead to more fulfillment?
Well, teach, write, that's all I do. Talk, but I'll continue to do that. One of the other areas that I've turned my attention to my profession, sports and recreation, has made contributions is the design of experiences that will teach those skills, those interests that are vital, that the psychologists have found to be vital parts of our well-being, will teach in the process of doing the experience, buying the experience. The example one of the better examples that I have, well, Airbnb, for example, $1 billion industry, but they're selling experiences. If you read their mission statements, it's wonderful. They said, we want to build community. That's so that in it that you have people you know in various cities that you stay at their place. Of course, it doesn't always happen that way at all, but that's their mission. That's what they intend to do. One of their products are experiences. So that if you go to Airbnb and you go to New York City, as we do a lot because our son lives there and his family, look up on Airbnb what are the experiences in the neighborhood, that Upper West Side, that are available. So I did that and came across a young fellow in Harlem who $80 will invite you up to his place and teach you to street dance. I'm much too old for that. I give it a shot, though. My grandson, Logan, said, Grandpa, I want to go with you.
Yeah.
So you go up there, and he'll take you to one of his kitchens and give you some lessons in street dances, introduce you to some of the people in his neighborhood, and get you to beyond your comfort zone into a place that stretches fear. Modulation is one of the strong things that the psychologists talk about. But experiences like that will teach, that will further community, that will build the skills are necessary for happiness.
You have been at the university for nearly 50 years, at the University of Iowa, and you've done a lot to build community during that time. That's been one of your personal missions. Can you tell me about some of the things at the university that you're proudest of?
Oh, yes. Everyone is gone. I'm the last of the the cohort that came through in my department and, well, in the other departments that I have had close contact with. So I have very few people left, but a variety of places. One of my major contacts in Iowa City is my church, the Trinity Episcopal Church. And we sung in the choir, my wife and I, since before we were married. So that's over 63 years. Oh, Lord. But we've sung together, and that's one of the things that has kept us at peace and convivial. It's a central part of our marriage, our singing together. But again, our community is in the at the church. I've served as a senior warden three times, and so that's an important part. But of course, all of the committees, all of the offices that I've held in various places, too numerable to mention.
So now that you have decided that it's time to retire, last time you were on the show, we were talking about retirement. That was the whole focus of our conversation. What made you decide that now is the time for you to retire?
Two things, Charity. My hearing is going. I have hearing aids that help a little, but that contact that I always have enjoyed and loved between myself and the students, and I'm having a hard time with that, increasingly hard. And I know the students are struggling, and they are very forgiving, but it's time. It really is. And the other thing is I'm running out of energy. Stephen Swanson, a good friend of mine who is retiring as well, he's in the baritone and the music department for years and years. been friends a long time. He gave his recital last Sunday, and a wonderful one of the tunes that he sang was Pete Seeger's "My Get Up and Go Has Got Up and Gone." That sort of sums it up for me. My energy level is getting. I have this one book that the history of work, that the rise of this new faith and the problems that it's having. It's a failing face. I want to write that book, so I need my energy to focus the last years of my life on this last project.
And I can't wait to read your book when that comes out.
Thank
and
you,
that's Jared. You definitely get to come back and be on the radio with us then as well. But I can imagine some people listening thinking, so he's retiring so he can do more work. But I mean, writing is something that you love, and having a pursuit that you find to be fulfilling, you feel like that is one of the secrets to happiness, right?
This is the Greek ideal, Aristotle, Plato, so forth. The word scholarship, the word school comes from a Greek word that means leisure. So it's those things that are worthwhile in and for themselves, worth doing without any necessary reward. You would do it if you're not paid or if you've received no benefit or attention from doing what you're doing. Those are the place where happiness resides, are those activities that are for themselves. Not only that you do it for itself, but you're eager to share. You want to give it away as much as possible. Share it with the people around you. That is scholarship for me. That's writing for me. Is that I do it for its own sake. It's hard. I think the mistake that we make about leisure is it's sitting on the sofa and not doing anything. For the Greeks and for the modern people like Robert Hutchins at Chicago, it's the very opposite. It's the time for the most... The greatest activity is where you're really enthused and you're excited about what you're doing. And it involves as much as we dance. My wife and I is one of the things I do for itself. And we talk about a polka sweat. We love the dance, but it's hard work. It's hardest work I do these days is dance around the dance floor of the polka. It's a two-step dance. It's a rum, not sure. But that's what... one of the things I try to teach is that leisure is not the absence of activity, but often the very definition of what it means to be energized.
Do you feel like we are moving farther away from our understanding of that, that it's getting harder for people to embrace and really understand the concept of leisure?
Charity, I'm more optimistic than I've been for a while. I've been pessimistic for a long time, and it's easy to be pessimistic. But looking around, I see younger folks who are looking at alternatives, who are looking at life in a bigger way than just focus narrowly on one career, and trying to arrange life, you know, into crevices around that one job, and they're looking at other possibilities. And I think that the 4-day work week as well, and the interest in that, gives me some optimism. I think that the question, the balance of work, and no one wants work to leave or go away, for goodness sake, but to achieve some sort of better understanding of free time, as well as a balance between free time and work, that would be more humane, that would be more looking forward to our development as human beings in a broader sense rather than in a narrow sense. I think things are changing a little.
In the last 4 years since the pandemic, one of the things that we've seen is that there are a lot more people working from home. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, that may give them more time outside of those working hours. But on the other hand, that can lead to isolation. And we know that loneliness, isolation, is a growing problem in this country. Does that worry you?
It does. Again, how to solve that?
People should definitely go dancing, and people should definitely sing together, right?
Well, there's a commercial part of it. I mean, the entrepreneur, if we could get the profit motive behind developing experiences where people develop to find community, that gives me hope that it's not the schools that are going to do it, but I would hope that the university would be able to teach some of the skills of freedom still. Mm-hmm. But maybe in the free market, that my students, as I encourage them, somewhere out there, you're an entrepreneur, can develop an experience like Airbnb, make billions of dollars, and come back to the University of Iowa and endow a chair in my name.
That's an excellent plan. It's so you are teaching students who are in their 20s, trying to impart these life skills that they can use in their careers, but also hopefully that they can use on a personal level for the rest of their lives. It's a time in your life when you take so much for granted. Do you hear from past students who come back and say, I use these skills all the time?
Charity, that brings tears to my eyes. It happens more as I'm retiring. It have students that come back and say things that make me weep. There's no greater reward to teaching than to have people to come back and say good job.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you've changed a lot of lives over the years. I mean, every time I talk with you, you make me think about my life in a different way. Although it's not just personal, it's our whole culture that you're trying to get us to look at, right?
Well, it's not me. It's people that Dorothy Canfield Fisher, Walt Whitman, all of these people who say these things, and what I've tried to do is represent all the voices that you hear, say it again, represent it in a way that is hearable, that is not just in some dusty textbook that no one looks at anymore. I'm not sure how much my students read it anymore, to tell you the truth, except their text messages. But anyway, to speak these words that have been so much a part of our past, of our optimistic past, our hopeful past, of the American dream. The American dream, the guy that wrote, who coined the phrase American dream, had these ideas in mind. No doubt about it. Read his book, James Thurslow Adams. Anyway, to represent those, it's not me. It's what I would like to represent that I think is important.
What is next? I know that you've got a lot of writing to do, but other than writing, what is next for you?
Well, we'd be going to, we have place visiting. That's it. Visiting. That one word comes to mind, visit. We'll be, we have a place in Asheville. Our daughter is, she has a new child, 8 months old.
Wow.
And we're Felix, we're little Felix. We'll look forward to going and visit. Sons in Raleigh and his family visit. My great-granddaughter is in Raleigh, visit little Grace. Little Gracie, she calls me at weird hours in the morning to text, to FaceTime. up to New York, my oldest son is in New York. And so we'd divide our time between Raleigh, New York, and Asheville visiting. That's what, and writing.
Family, community, and writing.
Exactly. Church, too. Singing.
Benjamin Honeycutt, thank you so much for all you've taught us over the years, and thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, Charity.
Benjamin Honeycutt has been with the University of Iowa since 1975. He's a professor of sport and recreation management. He's also a historian, and he has spent the last 50 years studying how we work, how we live, how we recreate, and trying to help us see a little bit better way in the future. Coming up in just a minute, a preview of Iowa City's Darwin Day celebration. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. The University of Iowa's Darwin Day is an annual celebration of the legacy of Charles Darwin. It's also an opportunity for scientists, teachers, and the public to learn from leading evolutionary biologists. Darwin Day is coming up this Friday and Saturday in Iowa City with lectures that are free and open to the public. You can find more information about it at iowacitydarwinday.org. Harmeet Malik is a professor and associate director of the Basic Sciences Division at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, Washington. He'll be speaking in the University of Iowa Biology Building on Friday afternoon at 4:30 on the molecular arms race between primate and viral genomes. That one is more geared towards scientists in the audience. On Saturday at 11:30 in Phillips Hall, he'll be giving a talk entitled Paleovirology, Ghosts and Gifts of Ancient Viruses. And I will be talking with him soon. We're working on our connection right now. And I believe he's with us. Dr. Malik, are you there?
I am, yes. Thanks for having
wonderful.
Me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here. And you study genetic conflict. Can you tell me what that means?
Well, genetic conflict study refers to the study of genetic elements that vie with each other for evolutionary dominance. A really good example of genetic conflicts is pathogens and hosts, where what is often in the best interest of the pathogen is contrary to the best interest of the host and vice versa. My lab is very interested in these kinds of arms races that take place either between different genetic entities, but what are even more interesting is conflicts that take place between entities that reside in the same genome, where they're kind of battling with each other for evolutionary dominance.
So what can we learn from understanding that battle for dominance?
Sometimes these evolutionary battles for sort of that have waged for millions of years can actually have profound present-day consequences. So, for example, one genetic conflict that takes place within our genomes is selfish genes that try to replicate themselves and jump to different locations in the genome just to, you know, increase their chances of being passed on to the next generation and being evolutionarily successful. But a consequence of that jumping activity is that they can often land into sites which will then debilitate the gene that they landed into, and that can actually have very profound consequences in terms of the genome and how it's altered. For instance, they could actually inactivate the gene. If the gene happens to be essential, that would lead to either death or some sort of developmental disability that arises because of the sort of unfettered activity of this arms race that's going on within the genome.
So this has implications for really a wide range of diseases?
Yes, we study these conflicts in the context of cancer, for instance, in the lab, but a very kind of important consequence is high rates of infertility and spontaneous abortion that takes place in many human populations where, again, sort of the unfettered activity of these elements can actually compromise the high fidelity of the process of egg formation and meiosis that can eventually lead to poor quality of embryos that are basically generated as a result of this. And this is something that we're very interested in terms of, you know, trying to understand why is it that some species have extremely high fidelity and other species actually seem to be quite poor at this very fundamental process of biological reproduction.
The work that you're talking about, it sounds like it could be so revolutionary across so many very important parts of human life. This is also work that wouldn't have been possible just a couple of decades ago. Can you tell me a little bit about this new frontier that we're all able to benefit from because of genome sequencing?
Thanks very much for that question. That's actually one of the really most fundamental insights that was gained from the draft human genome sequence that, you know, was released in more than two decades ago now, where we began to realize that the first big surprise was that we did not necessarily have more genes, so our genetic complexity was not much more complex than that of a fruit fly or a roundworm, even though we sort of tend to think of ourselves as a lot more complex. But the bigger surprise was how much of our genome was actually made up of these remnants of selfish genetic elements, including infectious viruses that had invaded our genome, almost like, you know, meteorites landing on the surface of the moon, and each imprint basically is left behind as a fossil version of the virus that initially landed in the genome.
So has that led to just an incredible explosion in the field of evolutionary biology?
There are a number of really dramatic insights that come from these imprints. So one really fantastic piece of evidence that comes from these imprints is, let's say that this transposable element or virus landed in a particular location, the genome. It turns out that now all the descendant species from that initial event will share that virus in exactly precisely the same location, which is very unlikely to actually happen by chance alone. And we have hundreds of these imprints. So really, by reconstructing an evolutionary history of species simply by looking at the imprints of these fossilized viruses in our genome, we can actually very faithfully reconstruct with a time element exactly how these speciation events happen. So it's really completely made all of the sort of conjectures that are based on, you know, fossil evidence, etc. Now we have a genomic fossil evidence which perfectly correlates with the archaeological fossil evidence that we've collected.
Wow. Okay. So on Friday, I mentioned that you'll be talking about this sort of molecular arms race between primate and viral genomes. And along the same lines, on Saturday, you'll be talking about paleovirology, which are these ancient viruses, these fossilized viruses that you're talking about. That conversation is going to be a little more geared toward the public, i.e. me. So tell me in layman's terms a little bit more about these fossilized viruses and where they come from.
So that's a fantastic example of where evolution has really shaped and chiseled our genomes over millennia. So, you know, one of the most surprising things when I tell people who are not in the business, as they say, is that if you were to sort of simply look at the pie chart of the human genome, it turns out that actually less than 2% of the human genome makes up all the things, proteins, RNA, that we think are actually useful for the human cell and for all of the things that we take up. Now, there's been a lot of controversy whether to refer to the rest of the genome as junk or unrelated, but actually what we can say unambiguously is 8% of the genome is actually made up of fossilized versions of viruses that have actually jumped into the genome over the last 35 million years of evolution. So really, even if you think about it simply as a, what makes up more of our genome, we actually have more, four times as many dead viruses in our genome than all of the good stuff that we think makes up all of the proteins and RNA. And so that's a staggering amount when you think about it. In the human genome itself, we have 100,000 independent imprints of invasions of retroviruses. And the way these invade the genome is that these retroviruses invade the cells that will form the sperm and the egg. And therefore, they not only actually infect these cells, but they actually infect the genome or the DNA of these cells. And so now you're actually passing on both the virus as well as the imprint of the virus to your progeny, and they'll pass it on to their progeny and so on. And so what we have is an accumulated history of retrovirus infections that have affected all of our ancestors over the last 35 million years of evolution. And so it's a sort of a staggering amount of DNA that we've simply collected. If you think about it, 8% of a genome has basically expanded our genome by 8% simply by the action of these viruses. What I'm going to talk about on Saturday is the fact that it's all not bad news, because it turns out that the human genome and primate genomes in general have been very clever about using some of these viral genes to actually conduct some completely new biological activities that were previously foreign to the human genome. And one of those biological properties is the ability to fuse cells, which is absolutely critical for the process of placental development or biological reproduction. So even like something as fundamental as how we produce babies in mammals may actually owe its evolutionary origins to a virus, which actually makes people at least raise one eyebrow.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think, we've all, hopefully all of us, learned the basics of evolution when we were in high school. But I mean, just this conversation gives us a peek behind the curtain into how broad and beautiful the influences are that lead to evolution in a species like humans.
I completely agree with that. I think it also sort of just shows us, since we are celebrating Darwin Day as part of these celebrations, about the great universality of features that really, unify so many aspects of life. You know, this is not just happening in the human genome. This is happening in all animal genomes to some extent. And so we all sort of share both this burden, but also in a way this legacy and the sort of the prospects of mining these dead viruses for completely new activities, which we have done in very clever ways. And that's kind of one of the things that the lecture is going to focus on, is that these are both ghosts of ancient viruses, but they're also gifts from ancient viruses that we basically have all exploited today.
Can you give me an example of a gift from an ancient virus?
Yeah, so one of the most profound examples of a gift is a gene called syncytin. Syncytin is a gene that actually is derived from the very gene that gives retroviruses the ability to infect cells. But that gene now exists in the human genome, even though the rest of the retrovirus is completely abraded away because of mutation. But the gene has been preserved. And you can ask, well, what is that gene doing now? Why has it been preserved? Why is it sort of kept intact? It turns out that that gene is absolutely essential for the very same process of cell fusion that the retroviruses use to infect cells. But in this case, the cell fusion is happening in the placenta. And that is an absolutely critical step to ensure that the developing fetus gets nutrition from mom through the process of cell fusion. So, in fact, if you actually generate mice strains that are deleted for their syncytin genes, they cannot sponsor pregnancies to term because they have lost the ability to pass on nutrition and nutritional information from mom to the fetus. And you can sort of think about how fundamental that process is for the survival of the species. And yet, in the human genome, this is being carried out by a gene that didn't even exist in our genomes until 35 million years ago, where it was brought to our genome thanks to a retrovirus that landed in our genome.
Wow, that is truly mind-blowing. I can imagine that, speaking of the general public, that sometimes when you start to talk about understanding ancient viruses, do you encounter a lot of fear? I mean, that makes people the bad guy in science fiction stories. Are people afraid of this knowledge and this work?
Well, the realization that these fossilized viruses actually already are present in a large fraction in our genome is a little bit sobering, right? Because this is not sort of the way we'd like to think about our genome. I joke often that if our genome was the IT department of a company, we would have fired the IT department a long time ago, given the number of viruses and junk we've accumulated. But the realization is that we are basically a product of these, viral invasions. This is not something to fear, but this is a very much an intricate part of our biology. Where the fear sets in is, what do we do with this information? So we are very careful in terms of how we study these arms races. So one of the things that my lab is very interested in is to try to infer what were the patterns of evolution that took place between, our ancient ancestors and these viruses when they were actually invading. So we can learn lessons by which we can design new immune strategies against these viruses. And that involves basically taking these fossilized versions and essentially reconstructing what these viruses would have looked like when they were in fact active. Now, that's where there is a potential to, for things to go wrong, because you don't necessarily want to be reconstructing or resurrecting zombie viruses. So what we do is we basically take each gene at a time, so it's not capable of becoming a virus, but we can still study fundamental properties of the virus, one protein or one gene at a time. And that has actually given us a lot of insights into how our ancestors fought off ancient viruses that are, related to scourges that are ongoing today, like HIV and Ebola, because those are lessons we can use to actually design the next generation of strategies against the very same viruses.
I can imagine that most of the public speaking you do is geared specifically toward scientists and very scientific focused audiences. Is it kind of a fun opportunity to get a chance to talk to a more general population?
It is a fun opportunity, but I have to say it's a lot more intimidating. Even just talking to you on the phone is a lot more intimidating, partly because we sort of have to watch just that we don't just slip into jargon that, we understand in the field, but is not jargon that would be immensely accessible. But mostly I just think of it as this enormous privilege and responsibility, because we are, after all, funded by, taxpayers, et cetera. And, it's actually a totally legitimate thing to ask, what is being done with this money that I'm actually, sending to the NIH? And it's really an enormous opportunity to basically speak to our bosses about the work that we do and, tell them about all the things that we've learned.
People do always want instant results, though, and so much has happened. There have been so many discoveries, so much forward movement in the last 20 years because of the human genome. But still, does it feel like it's not enough for people? People are impatient.
This is one of the, I think, perspectives that being an evolutionary biologist gives you that actually is kind of sobering but also useful, which is there's just this accumulated history of knowledge and education that we've really sort of benefited from, which we kind of take for granted. Even the medicines that we use routinely in the in the home today are really the result of like decades of work, which we sort of now take for granted. And it's really, on the one hand, it's easy to take those things for granted, but on the other hand, it's actually really a good reminder of just this accumulated history of knowledge that has really led us to where we are today. And honestly, where we will be even in the next 10 years, as these, genomic technologies get cheaper and even more powerful, and how we are going to be actually practicing medicine in the clinic is already fundamentally changing, especially, for example, in cancer research.
Harmeet Malik, thank you so much for talking with me.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Harmeet Malik is professor and associate director of the Basic Sciences Division at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle. He'll be speaking at the University of Iowa on Friday and Saturday as part of the annual Darwin Day celebration. Events are free and open to the public, and you can find out all about it at iowacitydarwinday.org. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbie.